And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really excited about this morning show today because we are talking about something incredibly important. What can we do to help the men and women who are coming out of prison, wanting to re-enter their respective communities and, in a sense, rebuild their lives, become law-abiding contributors to the community, and how can they find meaningful employment? There is an event coming up that can be a really important part of this puzzle. Coming up on Tuesday, October 2nd at Gateway's Horizon Center in Kenosha, it is the Southeastern Wisconsin Reentry Employment Expo. This is not a job fair. This is a resource fair designed to connect employers in the area with agencies that work with this particular population, that is, with people who are exiting prison and re-entering the community. And this is an expo in which employers, prospective employers, can connect with agencies that maybe exist right down the block from them, or certainly right in their own community, that they may not have otherwise any connection with whatsoever. And through some new partnerships, employers can find eager and well-trained, capable employees, and talk about a win-win. We're going to be talking with two different people very directly involved in this event, and someone else for whom this relates on a very, very personal sort of level. I'm happy to welcome back to the morning show James Schatzman, who is the director of Racine Vocational Ministries, which is one of about 25 agencies that work with this population that will be part of this expo. And we're also really happy to have with us on the morning show, I believe for the first time, Michael Gravely, who is the Kenosha County DA and someone who has really championed this in a very, very big way. And we'll introduce our third guest in just a moment. First, I want to welcome James Schatzman and Michael Gravely. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
James, just say a word about the lead role that Michael Gravely has taken in all of this, because you, as you were communicating with me, you mentioned that very specifically.
Well, this is an interesting event that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Milwaukee of the Eastern District has really taken the lead on helping to bring to areas and communities around the state. They're leading an effort to bring people and employers together. And it was several months ago that the U.S. Attorney's Office mentioned this to Michael, and he really ran with it. It's really been a pleasure. We've been working together, and I probably a good time to announce this. Racine Vocational Ministry has been working in Kenosha, and we do officially have a Kenosha Vocational Ministry office, and Michael was also helpful with that. We began to collaborate on how we could do this model in Kenosha, helping to bring people who have returned to the community together with employers and probation agents to help them get together, to help them figure out the best pathway in. And it's been very successful. We've been working for about a year now in Kenosha. And so when Michael heard about this, he just I think he ran with it. And convened us all together. We've been meeting at the district attorney's office now for probably about 2.5 months, every week, putting pieces together, calling employers, calling people and organizations who are helping to serve this population. And really, in the Southeast region, Michael has been our convener.
And it sounds like you were bitten with the bug, or struck by the lightning bolt, or whatever. But it sounds like this has just, in a sense, almost consumed you in terms of the importance of this event and giving your all to it.
I definitely feel it is an obligation of those folks who are directly involved in incarcerating individuals in this community to also be part of what happens when individuals are released from incarceration. So what's so excited me about this idea is, you know, if the criminal justice system is going to have justice as part of what we talk about, then you have to have real opportunities for folks when they are looking for additional chances, when they're looking for new opportunities to be pro-social. And so for me, this was an opportunity to speak to the business community, make sure that they heard that law enforcement and the DA's office were supportive of that conversation, and ask them in this time of difficult hiring issues for most of the major employers in our community to consider folks who are reentering from incarceration, to maybe give them a second look, because that really makes us safer as a community overall.
Absolutely. Jim, I want to give you a chance, actually, to introduce the distinguished gentleman that is sitting between you and Michael Gravely, somebody I had the pleasure of meeting not too long ago. I think it was at a, it was a funeral up in Racine, I think, where we met for the first time, I believe.
That was one of the times, yes, sir.
Yeah. Jim Schatzman, tell our listeners about our third guest, Carl Fields.
Carl is somebody that I've grown to know and love, and I say that unabashedly. He came to us from an extended prison stay where he took tremendous advantage of opportunities to change the way he thinks, and I'm sure that's going to come up in his conversation a little bit, because part of what happens in this business when you bring somebody into an agency like ours is we're helping not only to connect them to jobs and to opportunities, but also to begin to help shape a worldview that is away from criminality and to kind of community behavior. And in the correctional business, they talk about, Michael alluded to this, antisocial and pro-social thinking patterns. And, you know, we all have filters about how we think or how we view the world. And 90% of our decision-making is unconscious based on those filters that we've assumed. And when folks have lived a life of criminality, they've assumed a certain set of filters that kind of defaultly, in a default way, dictates how they engage the world. And so part of what you do, and Carl did tremendous work on this before he was even released, is to change that worldview. Mm-hmm. How do we begin to think of things in pro-social ways and take part in pro-social activities, which is not generally a part of somebody who's solidly in a criminal thinking patterns? And so when Carl came out to Racine Vocational Ministry, and he talked profoundly about knowing who we were before we came out and even referring people to our program before he came out because of some program that he was teaching prior to his release. And so he came to us hitting the ground running. We knew we had somebody who was pretty remarkable. His mental acuity, desire to give back and to share the message with people around him. Before I steal his entire story, I probably should just introduce Carl Fields.
Who's blushing here, I'm pretty sure. So. Carl, it's great to have you back on the morning show, and good to have you here. Your story is an important contributor to that.
Good to see you
again,
Grant.
At some point, we'll hear more about your story, but I would love to hear in your own words kind of your version of what Jim Schatzman was just talking about in terms of kind of the shift that you were able to have in yourself in terms of how you viewed the world and or the community.
Sure.
And what exactly changed about your view?
The abridged version is pretty straightforward for me. I was able to do some transitional, you know, transformative thinking because of an exception to a prison rule, which is one receiving their programming at the end of their prison term. That's the standard and that's the norm. I was one of the fortunate few to be able to get it on the front end of my prison term. And because of that, I was able to walk with it for some years to come. And that was a completely different, you know, opportunity. Very few people got a chance to do that. Most of the people who enter prison here in Wisconsin enter at a medium security level, and I went in at a maximum security level. And there, very few people want to take their programming, and so I had this opportunity to slide in immediately in year one with 17 years to go. And so the cognitive development stuff, all of these different options, came to me, and I took advantage of it. I had two basic opportunities, a four-month program or a two-year program. And I chose the two-year program. There were some guys who were incarcerated with me who were explaining some things to me about how prison life works, how I needed to shift my thinking around. I actually live here now, but in that I also need to act a certain way for the betterment of my opportunities in prison, because I would be shut down if I was still acting out and doing these, you know, adolescent-like things. But also in that, I learned how to fight for, you know, a level of dignity and respect in there as well. And as I did that, I began to want to do that for my peers as well. And the only real options that I saw was to get into programming, which is where there was a particular focus while in prison. And I did that for me initially, and then I began to do it for my peers. And before you know it, I was good at it. It was something that was, you know, it became my thing. And so when I transitioned from maximum security to medium, there was this focus on my folder that I had most of my programming out of the way, which was uncommon. And they asked me to come and work with the programs after that, and it just kind of took off after that.
So in other words, you went from being a recipient to a participant to being someone who was a leader.
Indeed. And it you know, it was partly a design and part design flaw. I mean, I didn't really, you know, see it all the way to the end in the beginning. But once I realized that this cognitive processes, they were powerful tools. They were something that the judge had mentioned as well. So, you know, I certainly give credit to Judge Merrick for putting me on that particular track, that particular way of thinking. I had taken psychology at home twice already. And, you know, the second time when I did pass it, I got a passing grade, and that was good enough. So when he started talking about these cognitive defects, I knew what he was talking about. I just had no idea that it was relating to me. And so when he spoke about these things, he laid out this plan, I guess you can say. And I had no real investment in this plan. But when he laid it all out to me, he said it in a way that I took it to mean that if I did these things, then I can get my life back and I can come home early. And so I said, okay, well, I'm going to prove him wrong. I don't have these cognitive defects he's talking about. And I started studying, and I was like, well, I'll be. I was like, all right, I do have these things that don't sit well together. And
such as what? Give us an example of one of those, what you're calling cognitive defects, right, that was, well, such an important part of who you were at that time.
Right. Well, I would say the biggest example is probably, you know, both a social example and a racial example. You know, I grew up in the margins, always have been there. And so I've been taught that a person like myself, a person who looks like me, can only rise so far in life, and that a certain kind of options pool is where I need to put my focus. And I got that from first grade. I got that from the way teachers talked to me. I got that from the way businesses and jobs and companies dealt with my parents. When I saw that, the way the police talked to my parents, when I saw that, all of that gave me these cues with which to act. And so by the time I was a middle schooler, you know, I was acting out and I was preparing myself for the life that I thought I was going to have. And so to unpack that, it took a lot of work. I also knew, because I had people on the righteous side of things too. I had good teachers. I had, you know, a righteous cop or two in my life. And they all said, well, you can be whatever you want to be. But the examples that they were both trying to tell me about and show me weren't as strong as the other kinds of examples.
Mm. You probably had too many of the other kind, and they were very potent. Yeah,
too many, indeed.
Right. So, just for a second, how long were you incarcerated, and at what age did you become incarcerated?
16 years. I went to prison at 21, and I got out probably about 2.5 years ago. I'm 39, just turned 39 a couple days ago, so 15 years, 10 months. I round up. So, I hope that's all right. I was in prison for a long time. I spent the bulk of my time in a medium security prison. They actually kicked me out of max because I was doing well. It's a weird thing. They sometimes do that. I was there. I took a lot of different cognitive programming there. I learned about conflict resolution in a different sort of way, but really embraced a restorative justice model in a way like never before. And that was just really something. And that's when I learned that the community isn't done any sort of, you know, solid by trying to give them a pound of flesh through giving somebody 100 years. It doesn't play out that way, because the community isn't made whole by that. The community is made whole by getting the people who've been harmed by crime engaged, the people who commit crimes engaged. If we can meet somewhere in the middle and help that person both to understand what they did, how they did it, why they did it, but also acknowledge that 90%+ of the people who are in prison are coming home one day. So this person needs to get into a transition type of way of thinking, and they need to do that from day one, in my opinion. If you can do all of that, and I believe it's possible because we have huge budgets around this stuff, then we really got something. My problem was that I knew that I couldn't transition for myself, so I had to figure out ways to help others do that while I was still in prison. And so I had to find a certain kind of positioning in prison to do that. Mm. The programs were a perfect place to be to help people think differently.
Wow. And you, along the way, ended up transforming your own thinking as well.
Indeed. It started out as, you know, I want to leave maximum security, so I'm going to take this program option and get it out of the way. They call them A&E needs in prison, and everybody's assessed with a certain kinds of needs or a certain level of needs. And prison is set up, though, to have you do those programs and finish them right around the time your release is coming, so that you can be on that wave of continuum of care. I believe that if that's going to be the case, then we need to do it on the front and the back end. I mean, otherwise you have a person sitting for 3 years, sitting for 5 years, sitting for 16 years when you want to give them programming in the last two. Mm. If I had set for 13, 14 years, I don't know what kind of person I would have been.
Right. That's really scary to think about, isn't it?
It's a policy, and there needs to be a policy shift right there. Mm. I mean, I'm on my community organizer soapbox right now, but but yeah, it needs to be a shift there. So in the work I do, I push hard for that. I involve myself in programs and events like this because all voices need to be at the table, but there also needs to be some decision-making abilities with those people who you invite to the table.
Well, Kenosha County DA Michael Gravely is vigorously nodding his head in agreement that, I mean, although we're today talking about an event that mostly is for the sake of people who are out of prison, Carl Fields is raising a really important point about that part of this piece needs to be what happens to prisoners while they are incarcerated as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the reasons I'm nodding my head is it's wonderful that the community gets a chance to hear Carl's wisdom about sort of his own experience and what that means to the entire criminal justice system. And, you know, one of the things I'd like your listeners to know is that Carl's an extraordinary individual. It's really been a pleasure to have personal conversations with him and be on some forums with him. But there are a number of other stories of individuals who are much like Carl, who have been incarcerated in our community and have come out and really have a wisdom and a message for us, and are the kind of folks who have really transformed their lives. And, I think we as a community sometimes simplistically write off people. And, you know, Carl is a great example, but there are many other examples of folks who just refuse to be written off, and they're a cautionary tale for the community, being sure that we make sure everyone we deal with, including those we incarcerate, are really and truly human beings.
Right. I want to just insert a story that I will keep as brief as I can. This past May, I had the real privilege of stepping inside the doors of the Racine Correctional Facility in Sturtevant, to experience a performance of Shakespeare's Cymbeline, performed by some of the inmates there under the direction of UW Parkside's Jonathan Shaler. And I didn't know what to expect, but I was excited at the opportunity to see this, but I kind of thought I would be kind of gritting my teeth through what I thought would be, you know, kind of like a middle school level performance. I couldn't believe the excellence of what was done, of what was achieved by these gentlemen. And by the end of it, as I was walking out of there, I was thinking of those guys who were not walking out there of there with me, who were walking back to their cells. I feel like for the first time in my life, I was thinking about the plight of those who are incarcerated, in terms of what awaits them when they come out. And I was thinking about each and every one of these guys that I saw perform in this play and some of whom I got to talk with. And just realized that if I hadn't had that experience, I would be like, I would never think about this issue in that way. And most of us don't think about this issue in that really visceral, direct way. And I hope we're all, in one way or another, kind of coming to think about this population in different ways, seeing them as human beings and seeing them as people who have something to contribute. Yeah.
And I want to tell you how I came to it. So I've been a prosecutor since 1989, and one of the things that I know about myself is that I've been a part in this county of sending over 1,000 people to prison. Hmm. And that's the kind of thing that should be a sobering consideration for anyone. But because I've done the shooting cases in Kenosha County for more than 15 years, I had the opportunity to deal with individuals I incarcerated as victims as well. So I have had hands-on personal experiences with many of the people I incarcerated and their families as victims in cases, you know, who I jealously and tried to advocate with every bit of passion that I could bring to the table. So I already was ready to think about each person we incarcerate as a living, breathing, fully functioning, savable human being. And that, you know, and that comes from those varied experiences with the same individuals that are in that 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Jim Schatzman, say a word about the work that an agency like Racine Vocational Ministries does when somebody like a Carl Fields comes out of prison. What is your mission? What do you try to do? What do you try to give to these men and sometimes women, I'm sure, that are just out of prison and anxious to re-enter the community in a meaningful way?
Kind of one way to think about the services that we do at Racine Kenosha Vocational Ministry is we talk about our services as transformational. And I would set that up against a more transactional type service where you come in, you get your resume cleaned up, if there is anything to put on it, you help somebody interview stronger, and then you send them out the door. We are really working with the correctional system in this cognitive services to help people change the way they view their world. I think we do a disservice when we begin to work with somebody who just has all these social challenges, and you just simply give them a job skill and send them out, and they still have they bring their social challenges right with them to the next step. Mm. And so,
and I suppose that makes it all the more likely that they're going to fall back in those old patterns and at some point be back in prison, or it's more likely if you haven't thought about those kind of issues as well.
It also reinforces the narrative that Carl was talking about, that, you know, because of the color of my skin or because of my felony background or because of the way the community's always treated me, nothing's really changed. Somebody gave me a job skill, somebody, you know, talked nice to me, but I'm still not getting the opportunity. I'm still not getting ahead. And when your filters put you in another direction, a lot of what is coming at you is invisible. You don't properly in a pro-social way process the information that happens. And it could be as simple as being critiqued on your job, you know, and the supervisor's looking over your shoulder and the person's feeling like this is a little bit like a prison guard, you know, correcting everything I do and telling me I never get anything right. You have to work through those filters before you get in the job. Or it's kind of dog-eat-dog, or, you know, survival of the strongest, the old, you know, Roman rule of rule by domination. You got to overcome those thoughts to be able to live in a healthy way in a pro-social community. You can't just place somebody with a criminal macro into that place and expect them to survive because their view of the world is different. They just – and even if they try real hard, we've seen this happen before – the gentlemen go back, they go into the workplace and they're working really hard, they're performing really well, but they don't know how to behave around people. Mm. And because of their background and they're not fitting in, 90 days into their work experience, the HR director says, you know, you're pretty good at your job, but you just don't fit in. You know, the guys are a little afraid of you in the parking lot because you don't talk to anybody. You know, small talk is not something, it's not a big part of people who come out of gang activity. you know, talking about the football team. That's not what they do in the general public. And so without that kind of shift, that doesn't happen. So we're focusing on how do you behave in your environment? How do you understand your family of origin? Are they helping you or hurting you? If they're hurting you, how can you behave in that situation where you're not going to be thinking the same way? How can you find a set of pro-social friends? How can you begin to incorporate a set of pro-social activities? A lot of the folks we've worked with have never gone on a school field trip. Their classmates go, but they stay home. So we've gone to art museums and all these kinds of things, and other parts of our classmates have never gone to those things. So they don't get the kind of educational benefit we've gotten. So we tell people, do something different. Go to a museum. You know, if you go to a different job agency, they're not going to tell you, you ought to go to a museum. You ought to take your kids, you know, to a symphony concert. Go to an opera, you know. Even if you only go once, you've seen it. You've seen a completely different view of the world that you had no idea was part of your community.
So it's part of changing their kind of worldview and their view of themselves, and also fostering some of the social skills that they've maybe not learned or have not been nurtured, and just so they can function beyond just the what they have to do on the job, but how they can flourish in the community. And
the view of themselves is also another just critical part. You know, we are a ministry. We're not proselytizing or running prayer groups. But the fundamental that we operate out of is that all people are created with gifts and talents and aptitudes that they've been knit together in the womb by the Creator. And as such, we follow the implications of that. This person has something to offer. How do we draw that out?
Right.
And I've heard you use this phrase before. It's never left me, that education is more like starting a fire than mm-hmm. pouring, is that yeats?
Right, yes.
Than filling a bucket.
Right.
And so how do you draw out what's there? Because we believe there's something there to draw out. And quite frankly, to a lot of our participants, that's a surprise.
Right.
They had never been treated that way before.
Right.
We're just going to fix you like a broken toy, and then you're going to function properly, rather than reaching on the inside and pulling out what's there. Nobody dreams of being a career felon. Nobody wakes up and says, gosh, that's what I aspire to do. But those dreams have been killed because of lack of opportunity or the macros they get in the communities that they live in. So how do we begin to undo that, unpack that? Quite frankly, the job piece takes care of itself. If you can get a person to the point where they believe in themselves, the point where they believe in the opportunities that are out there, we don't do nearly as much on job placement as we do just helping people to understand how the world works and to understand that what they have is valuable.
For those of you just joining us on the morning show today, we have in our studios Jim Schatzman from Racine Vocational Ministries, Michael Gravely, Kenosha County DA. Both have been really active in an event coming up on Tuesday, October 2nd. The Southeastern Wisconsin Reentry Employment Expo. With us as well in the studios, Carl Fields, who has done great work with Racine Vocational Ministries, and he is part of the population, or has been part of the population, that is ultimately serviced by this important event coming up at the Gateway Horizon Center on Tuesday, October 2nd. That is people out of prison who want to be a meaningful part of the community and find meaningful employment and contribute and leave that past life behind them as emphatically as possible. Michael Gravely, you were saying that there are a couple of things that make this an important time in terms of this issue. One of them, I think we've heard a lot about, that's just kind of the numbers in terms of unemployment rate being quite low and a lot of employees really desperate to find good, hardworking, capable employees. So there is that reality on the one hand. But you were mentioning something before we went on the air that I think is not on the radar screens of most of us. Now, that has to do sort of with the way in which this is a new generation of in terms of how their past can, in a sense, really follow them, even kind of haunt them in a way that was not true, for instance, for our generation. Explain to our listeners what you're talking about there.
Well, so a conversation I have in this community very frequently is that, you know, technology is a tool, and of course it has so many advantages in our lives. And anytime you adopt a tool in terms of your entire society, it has some pieces that are unexpected consequences as well. And one of those is that as we live in Wisconsin now, this young generation, so individuals who have just finished between the years of 16 and say 23, and had lives with a lot of chaos. They had some criminality. They had all sorts of other situations that were difficult, and they made poor and many times immature choices. This is the first generation, I believe, in Wisconsin's history where those choices will be available in easy, accessible data for anyone who wants to look at them for their entire life. The generation I grew up in, I'm in my early 50s now, those individuals I picture when I think of youths where a lot of mistakes were made, those mistakes have disappeared as those individuals had the normal maturing process that happens for persons throughout human history. And so when they matured enough that, you know, they got married or they joined a church or they got to a point where they got sick of, using drugs or alcohol in the same frequency, they then went on to some productive things. And part of the reason they were able to be productive and join the middle class and have middle class opportunities is because much of what they did as a young and reckless youth, much of the hell they raised, is a secret. And these are the very same people sometimes when I talk to, they say, well, I can't give an opportunity to someone because they're a felon or because they had this happen when they were 17. And I think to myself, you know, didn't you grow up in a generation where people were doing many of these same things and then we hired them in their 20s because no one knew it? And so we got to be very careful about that. Knowing that the new calculus is we will know a lot more about the youth of virtually everybody that we come across, we have to be sure that we don't lose the opportunity for people to grow up, to make different decisions at different places in their life.
So in other words, it is a tougher situation, even though numerically the employment job market is quite promising. I mean, more promising than it's probably been in recent years. But there is this other reality that, in fact, makes it a more difficult environment for someone just out of prison, perhaps, to find employment.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that anybody honestly thinking about this will realize that things like CCAP, which is our sort of database here in Wisconsin, make it more difficult for people who raised hell in their youth to be able to overcome that in the second, third chapters of their life.
Right. So you've talked to a lot of employers, and in fact you were saying that every single employer you've talked to pretty much is planning on coming to this event coming up on Tuesday, October 2nd. So there is great interest out there in this, and it sounds like a certain level of openness to this possibility of hiring someone who is out of prison. Just how much openness is there out there? And when there is hesitancy, typically what does that hesitancy sort of center around?
So one of the tasks I was given as the district attorney was to make some personal calls to folks who make hiring decisions. And I was rightly asked to talk to many of the sort of signature employers in the Kenosha area. So, and what I found universally was not only an agreement to come, but excitement to come to this event. So the businesses would be in a few categories. There are some businesses that have not made any kind of hiring decisions of folks who were felons or haven't sort of dipped their toes in this pool of the labor force. And they're coming because they want to be sure as a business that they're not missing out on a hiring opportunity or something that other folks in the business world are going to take advantage of. There's another group who maybe have a relationship with one agency, and so they've hired individuals through that agency. But they have no idea, as I don't think anybody really thinks about this, that there are 25 separate agencies in our southeastern Wisconsin that are going to be there, all of whom are dealing with different individuals and provide a variety of services to prepare them. So in overall, here's what I can tell you. I've been incredibly impressed with the Kenosha business community and their enthusiasm and really their good corporate citizenship here. They are individuals who were excited to do this and to be a part of this, and all of the major corporations from Ocean Spray to Uline to Meijer, Snap-on, you know, all the major corporations in our community have indicated that they want to be a part of this because of their feeling of obligation and corporate citizenship, but also because they think it makes some economic sense.
And let's make sure people understand the point that you were just making that I think is so important, which is that not only will Jim Schatzman and Carl Fields be there from Racine Vocational Ministries, but people from comparable agencies, 25 or so in all, are also going to be there. So if somebody from Ocean Spray knows Jim and Racine Vocational Ministries, or somebody from Snap-on knows Carl, they might not actually even be aware of the existence of these other agencies and the people that these different agencies are also working with who represent other potential pools of possible employees.
Absolutely. What I would say to that is that a lot of different agencies deal with people according to different criterias. And the hard part for me has always been, especially in the beginning of my release and my transition, was that there were organizations that I knew of that existed, but I didn't fit into their model for one criteria or another. And so that narrow kind of scope ultimately kept me out of the job market. I came home injured, and so the jobs for which, you know, felony be to the side, they would hire me, I couldn't do because I had back issues. And then there was also the jobs for which, you know, a technical proficiency was needed or necessary that I could jump a hoop with, but that scarlet letter was not something they could get past. And then out of that pool of jobs, a few of them were willing to take a look at me, but then they couldn't get past the fact that I had been gone for so long. And they're like, well, you need to reassimilate, and we're unsure if that can be with us. And so, you know, part of it is how they make their decisions in hiring, but also what sort of backlash are they going to have to endure from hiring somebody like myself. And so that's a social piece that we all got to get on board with and have the courage to do and be accepting of, in my view.
Right. So, Michael Gravely, what typically spells the difference or makes the difference in terms of a good match between a potential employee and someone just out of prison? What are the things that, in a sense, have to be in place for it to be a good match?
Well, you know, I think for the employer, an employer is quite rightly risk averse. You know, they're running a business to support their family, their stockholders, you know, et cetera. So they want to be risk averse. And so the agencies are going to be at this particular event are going to be agencies that are going to help reduce those employers' risk. They're already monitoring individuals. They're vetting individuals. They're training individuals. So they're providing all of the sort of things that help reduce employers' risk. And so as I have conversations with these businesses, I say, where will you ever find another group of people who are willing to do all that work on the front end to have you have the best possible employee? Mm.
So as opposed to somebody, say if Carl just walked out of prison and then walked into Snap-on and applied for a job and with nothing of that behind in terms of the work he had done at Racine, Carl or anybody in that situation, they would be at an enormous disadvantage versus somebody where you can, in a sense, come bearing the signature of a group like Racine Vocational Ministries. That means something else. Right. And they in a sense attest to your preparedness. Right.
And then you as an employer then have a relationship with this agency. So it's this agency essentially in some way vouching for the individuals that they're placing. So now you as an employer have that sort of feeling of ballast in terms of your worry about risk as well, because you know this is a relationship that agency is going to want to continue. They're going to try to provide you the best resources they can to have this employer work out for you, employee.
And Jim Schatzman, I suppose a really important piece of this is that, in a sense, you are not only concerned with those folks out of prison that you are serving, but in a sense, your own integrity and reputation is also very much on the line, and so you do not lightly vouch for person X until you really have every reason to believe that they, in fact, can be successful in the workplace.
This is a very challenging aspect of this work. You really have to, and I share this with my case managers all the time, we have to separate the anxiety of the participant from the readiness of the participant. You know, our folks many times are very desperate. They don't have any money. They're possibly homeless or on the verge of homelessness. They're living in families that are already struggling with poverty issues, and now they become another burden to the household, and they bear that. And when they come, they're like, man, you just got to get me a job. I've got to get something. And our job is to assess also whether they're work ready, because if we're just sending people out and hoping, you know, throwing spaghetti against the wall, so to speak, and just hoping a few pieces stick, you know, that's a strategy that will burn bridges with employers very quickly.
Exactly.
And so you really have to help people to understand that there are two aspects to work. None of us started work where we are now, and I'm looking at Michael, and I'm saying, you know, his first job wasn't to be the district attorney of Kenosha. His first job was probably waiting tables somewhere, or bussing tables as a 15-year-old somewhere, or working on a neighbor's farm. You know, you start at a place that's not living wage, but when you come out like Carl did, and he's 36 or 37 years old, and you say, look, you might have to work at McDonald's to get started. That is not very exciting. But if you literally don't understand the work process, or you've never been supervised before, you don't understand the processes, and you put somebody in at too high a level, they're likely going to fail. Right. And so you have to assess at the individual level, is this person ready to work in retail, or is he ready to go to maybe a packaging organization and make $9 or $10 an hour and no insurance, and no, that's not living wage, but you're getting some traction, you're getting something on a resume, so that when I talk to Snap-on, I say, God, I have a guy who's already been working 3 years. He's been steady. He's got some letters of reference from an employer. Can I send him your way? Is really different than, I know this guy that got out of prison 4 days ago, and he's really, really desperate. Could you put him on? Right. And we've all had that conversation off the record, but we've learned that you have to be a little careful. You have to make sure people are ready for the opportunity that you're presenting them for. It's an opportunity for some very honest dialogue that is often very hard to have.
Sure. And I should think what we're talking about here is a delicate balance between your compassion, the compassion that the people that work for you have, with sort of a steely also practicality and realism about what people can do, what is going to be possible. That has to be hard to keep those in the right kind of balance.
It is, but part of the message is, and I want to share that with employers who may be on their way to work today and hiring managers, there is a pool of people in this population who are extremely ready to work. They're extremely eager to work. They know why they want to work, but the opportunities are few. And so as this, we're coming to this point in our time where we have less people in the job market and an increasing job pool here in the area, these 25 organizations that are working with some of these more challenged populations need to be taken seriously as opportunities to bring people into your workforce. They're eager and ready.
Michael Gravely, I know that one of the things that really excites you is that this is an event that draws together all kinds of different entities in a way that's just about unprecedented. Just help our listeners understand all the different pieces that are part of this event coming up on Tuesday, October 2nd.
Well, I mean, you know it's the right time for an idea when you can bring very diverse coalitions of people together that really don't normally sit on the same page. So, you know, a huge sponsor and folks who've put a lot of work into this have been CABA, so the major business entities, and the Kenosha Chamber of Commerce, the Racine equivalents of that have been very, very influential. The County Executive's Office has been a big force in this. The Department of Social Services, law enforcement, the faith community has been a huge part of this from at all points and at all planning pieces. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the DA's Office. So you have the faith community, you have the business community, you have probation and parole, you have the prison system, you have community activists, and you have the agencies that do this work. all in the same place, saying the same thing, which is that this community is safest when we provide real opportunities for those who are coming out of incarceration. This community is most just when we provide those same opportunities. This community is a place really living its faith when we provide those opportunities. You know, so no matter where you approach this from, it's really the right idea at the right time. And I really hope people will show up at 7:30 on October 2nd to make a shameless plug and see all of these people together with that same message and show your support for this so that the folks who fund these ideas, the folks who think about what we can do in the future, will see by the number of people who are present at the Horizon Center that this idea is really something we support as a community.
So if people are interested in attending this, and we do want to reemphasize that this is not a job fair, this is not that kind of event, but it is an event to bring potential employees together with the agencies that can connect them to great people like Carl.
Not employees, employers.
Employers, right. With potential employees, yes. So do people have to register, or can they just appear? Can they just come?
So if you want to come just to the opening session, which is from 7:30 to around 8, and just hear the welcoming remarks, there's likely to be some breakfast for you there at no charge, and you'd be able to show your support. If you're an employer who wants to walk through and see the table displays for each of these agencies, that certainly could be done in less than a half hour, then you can come anytime from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. There's no need to register. There is a registration process, and we certainly appreciate registration, but please do not let that be an impediment to coming to this event.
Great. I want to give Carl Fields the final word. Carl, and I'm afraid in about a minute or so, I would really appreciate it if you would just share a thought for anybody listening out there who is in a position of hiring somebody. What would you have them think about today that they maybe haven't thought about before?
Jim certainly touched on a point of view that we share and that we're in step with, and that is the mechanics of all this. A job doesn't fix this. A job doesn't, put an end to recidivism numbers. Neither does a good place to live, but they are pillars and they do help. To unscramble some of my old thinking and some of our old thinking takes some real work. Some of that has to happen before, but sometimes it just can't. It has to happen once they're released and we can get our hands on them to help them do that.
Right.
I feel like I'm a community organizer with a group called Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. We're a statewide group, and we operate both in Racine and Kenosha, and so that's why I'm part of this in the way that I am. I would say that there are a lot of guys like myself, men and women, who are doing this work, who are looking for real opportunities, and those barriers are barriers that not just exist for us, but they exist for employers who do have the courage to take these steps and hire people like myself, but they can't seem to come from under that. This is a place where they're all there and saying, look, we're all going to do this as a group. We're all going to do this as a community. Mm-hmm. And we're all going to bear the brunt of this because the recidivism numbers reflect that something else needs to be done.